Today we've moved round another 90 degrees in the mandala, and we're in the western direction. And in the west we find the Buddha Amitabha, infinite light. So let's start again by imagining Amitabha in our mind's eye, wherever that is, in our heart. So again, we can start by seeing just openness, just open blue sky, complete freedom, no limitations, completely ungraspable. And then within that appears this wonderful red figure made of red light, and this is Amitabha, and he's seated on a red lotus and a white moon mat, and his lotus throne is supported by peacocks. The extraordinary plumage of the peacocks. And he's in deep meditation. His hands rest in his lap in the, it's called the Dhyana Mudra, the Mudra of Meditation. So the thumbs are just touching, and the mudra is embracing a certain space, a certain empty space. So this mudra is, amongst many other things, a symbol of balanced effort, because the thumbs do just touch. If there was too much effort, the thumbs would be pressed together, they'd sort of steeple upwards. If there was less effort, they wouldn't quite touch, they wouldn't quite make the connection. So there's just the right amount of effort. And then he's dressed in jewels and silks, usually, because he appears on this sort of visionary level. We talked yesterday, Ratnaprabha talked about Ratnasambhara as the Buddha of beauty. But in a way, all these five Buddhas of the mandala, they're all on a level of heightened awareness. And on that level of heightened awareness, everything appears beautiful. And also they're all on a level of positive emotion, they all have open hearts, and on that level everyone appears beautiful. And Amitabha is smiling. He's smiling with deep compassion. He's smiling with deep compassion for all life, every kind of life whatsoever. And his body gives off radiance. So this is the form, the usual form that we see within the mandala. Sangharakshita, you may know, had a vision in a cave of a slightly different form, where often Amitabha is also represented as seated on a lotus in the midst of an ocean, in the midst of a calm ocean. So Sangharakshita had an image of Amitabha not seated in Dhyana Mudra, but holding up a red lotus in his right hand. And beyond the lotus in the distance was the setting sun. But today we'll focus perhaps more on the Dhyana Mudra. And Often that dhyana mudra, resting in it, is, as in this painting here, is a red lotus, with all the qualities of the lotus, all that openness, all that sense of growth and unfoldment, all that purity. So this is the figure with whom we'll be living today, who will be living with us today. And as with all these Buddhas, there are a lot of different associations with him. There are associations which connect his level of experience to the everyday world. So he's associated with a colour, yes, with red. He's associated with a direction, with the west. Associated with sunset. Associated with the natural world through the lotus and the peacock. But then there are other associations. He's associated with transmuting craving into what's called discriminating wisdom. He has a number of very important figures in his family, including Avalokiteshvara and Padmasambhava, and some forms of Tara, especially white Tara. And he's associated with the throat chakra and communication, with attraction and fascination, and with the seed syllable Hri, which has now appeared in the western quarter of our mandala here. And his mantra, Om Amideva Hri. So if we see our journey around the mandala as not simply, right, we started in the east and we left that behind, and then we went to the south and we left that behind, and now we are in the west. If we see it as a cumulative journey, so that we're taking with us everything that we saw, everything that we learnt in the east, everything that we learnt and understood in the south, then our journey around the mandala becomes a deepening, just a deepening of previous understandings, taking them further and further. And in terms of seeing our system of practice within Sri Ratna in that way, we've moved from integration, from doing that basic work of getting to know ourselves, of coming into contact with our experience, with our body, with our feelings, and from there moving on into positive emotion and developing metta, developing Brahma Viharas, developing a very positive sense of self, a sense of self that's on good terms with itself. So now we move on around the mandala and we come to spiritual death, as it's called. Which, as I mentioned last week, is a kind of mixed blessing, perhaps, as a term. Because none of us really wants to die. So if you feel like, okay, I'm moderately integrated and I have my flashes of positivity, so what's the next stage for me? You think, next stage is I'm going to die. That doesn't necessarily do that kind of rite of fascination and attraction of Amitabha, of leading you on. So it's good just to be aware of that, but you may have sort of underlying kind of reactions to that term, spiritual death. And yeah, see if you can just let those go, because in a way, it's just pointing out the fact that beyond the stage of positive emotion, there is a real transformation. There's quite a radical transformation, a radical movement. Yes, you're going from what Sankaracharya terms effective going for refuge to real going for refuge, and that's a real change. That makes a real difference. Another way of putting it is that you are going much more deeply into what Buddhism calls bodhicitta, into the heart of awakening. And in that heart of awakening, you're practicing to gain an awakening, to gain enlightenment, but doing so for the benefit of all beings. There's a very strong sense that you're not just practicing for you. In fact, in a way, you're practicing for all beings. And bodhicitta has two main aspects. There's a wisdom aspect and a compassion aspect. And they go hand in hand. And in our own practice, on our own level, we need both those aspects. We need the wisdom side and the positive emotion, which increasingly becomes compassion. So Amitabha is associated with, on the wisdom side, discriminating wisdom, and also within our view of things, the way that Kamalashila and Sabuti have been outlining, with spiritual death. So looking at the wisdom side, we'll look just a little bit at both those aspects. Firstly, discriminating wisdom. This, all these wisdoms are ways of seeing the nature of our experience. We're not, on this level, we're not concerned so much about the content of our experience. We're looking to see what's common to all our experience, doesn't matter what it is. And one of the aspects that's common to all experience is that there's something unique about it. Because everything arises in dependence on conditions, and those conditions are unthinkably vast and complex. In every moment, what arises is completely unique. There's never been exactly that moment before or since. Now, this moment that we're sharing together now has arisen in dependence upon a vast number of conditions. All the conditions which led you to decide to get involved in Buddhism, all the conditions which led you to decide to come on this particular retreat, all the conditions that led you to be sitting in exactly the attitude that you're currently in, thinking exactly the thought that you're having right now. Vast, unthinkably vast. And the more you go into it, the more vast it is. All the conditions that enabled Padmaloka to be here, all the conditions that enabled Sirlium to be here, all the conditions that enabled the galaxy to be here, and so on and so forth. Yeah, you can go as far as you like. So this moment is unique, absolutely unique. And that's true of every experience. So there are some ways in which all experience is the same, but also you can see that every experience is unique. And it's seeing that uniqueness, which is a major aspect of discriminating wisdom. You can say the same thing about people. It's like yesterday we were focusing more on what's common about us all. Like we did that meditation where we were reflecting on the fact that whoever we were, still, we all like to get what we like to get. You know, we're unhappy when we get separated from what we like. We're unhappy when we get what we don't like. We're all getting older. We're all subject to illness. We're all subject to death. So that was, you know, you can say, well, there's a wisdom of equality. Yeah. We have all that common ground. But also, we're all unique individuals. There's never been and never will be, you know, an Amoghavadra. You know, just Amoghavadra is a unique experience that we have. Yeah? But you know, people of the past have never had, people of the future will never have. Yeah? But we have the opportunity to have that experience. And the same goes for each and every one of us. So in that sense, there's a valuing of seeing the particular kind of qualities and uniqueness of each person and appreciating that. And yeah, sometimes people are different from us and they kind of rub up against us and we don't like it. But actually it's really good to appreciate the fact that people are just different. If they all were just like us, you might think, well, that would make life so simple. But actually, I think we would actually find that it didn't. And that variety, that wonderful richness of life would no longer be there. So yeah, in that sense, we're all unique, we're all special. Although you can also take that in the wrong kind of way. There's a sort of near enemy of this, which is really kind of rampant in some parts of society today. The whole thing about having to be special is such a big thing. You know, sort of the whole marketing industry has really gone behind this. You know, special is a really kind of good marketing word. You know, you have to find that special gift for that special occasion, with that special person, and yeah, so that you feel special. And you know, young kids are really kind of encouraged, you know, to feel special. And whilst I appreciate that valuing and that wanting to build up the confidence and the sense of worth of people, it also ends up putting a whole lot of pressure on people and on kids, because there's a whole pressure to stand out and to be special and to find something that's your thing, that is nobody else's thing. When I was younger, I had people who kind of, friends of mine who were kind of interested in Buddhism through me, but they'd say, well, yeah, but I don't want to get involved in Buddhism because, you know, that's your thing. I want to find my thing. Like they, you know, whereas it could have been everybody's thing, you know. But yeah, they needed to find their special thing. And they had to find a way of standing out. Kind of reading some things from some of the teenagers I know. It's almost like they're kind of almost looking to market themselves in some kind of way, almost to find their USP, their unique selling point, you know, that they can kind of present to the world. And that, yeah, there's just a lot of pressure in doing that. There's a lot of pressure in having to stand out. There's a lot of pressure in having to be special. Maybe it's because there's 7 billion of us on the planet now. You know, you feel like you have to do something to kind of get noticed and stand out. But the thing is, that's adding another head to your original one, as it says in Zen. Yeah, we already are special because we are unique. Yeah. We don't need to kind of think in terms of creating extra specialness. We just need to be the unique person that we already are, yeah, as fully and as, you know, creatively as possible. So yeah, there's never been any of us before, and there never will be again, and this moment will never happen again. So seeing that helps you to really value the people that you have contact with. You can see every moment of your day is really like that. Yeah. It's to be savoured and appreciated because, yeah, it is unique. So that, on some level, is a little bit about discriminating wisdom. So, just a little bit also about spiritual death. A more traditional term for spiritual death in Buddhism would be insight. Insight into the nature of things. And spiritual death seems to be particularly stressing insight into the nature of me. It kind of suggests a letting go of the story that we tell ourselves about who we are, and in particular the story that we tell ourselves about how we're separate from the rest of life. I did talk a fair bit about this in the talk last week, where we were looking at how Amitabha arose out of the episode under the Bodhi tree, where Mara's armies attacked the Buddha, and the representatives throwing all kinds of weapons and tree trunks and things at him as he's to try and drive him away from being on the point of gaining enlightenment. And the Buddha just sat in meditation in this deep dhyana, and all the weapons, all just on as they touched that aura, just transformed into flowers. And we talked about that in terms of dwelling in the gap between sort of stimulus and response, between stimulus and response. We talked about it in terms of positive emotion, but we also talked about it in terms of insight. So I'm not going to go back over all that ground again, but and all the talks from last week, if you're interested, if you missed them, they should all appear on Free Buddhist Audio at some point. If you want to just tap back into this retreat after it's over. Yeah, now I just want to touch on the idea that spiritual death has different sorts of stages. And there can be a sort of real spiritual death at the point where you completely see through what you think of as a fixed, inherently existing me standing behind my experience. And you see, no, that's just more thoughts, that's just more feeling, that's as ungraspable as anything else is. But on the way to that, there are experiences that are akin to that, that are like that, that are heading in that direction. And I can certainly see, looking back at my practice over the years, how there have been certain experiences which have felt quite like a spiritual death in one way or another. I think when I was saying to somebody yesterday, when I first started practicing, my sense of who I was pretty rigid and pretty fixed. You know, I thought I was like this kind of small box, you know, that was me. And as not long after I started to meditate, just through having a little bit more mindfulness and a little bit of awareness, I discovered aspects of myself that didn't fit into that small box of what I thought I was like, the kind of person I thought I was. And at a certain point, because that view was held so tightly, and because I kept on trying to hold it, and as it were to shut out the bits of my experience that didn't fit in the box, at a certain point, when I had to kind of admit that, yes, that wasn't who I was really, I wasn't like that, or at least that was only a part, it's almost like there's a kind of explosion with sort of shrapnel of my self-view kind of flying in different directions. And then a period of not really knowing who the hell I was. But then after a while, things would settle down, and I'd kind of get a more realistic sense of who I was, which would be somewhat larger. It would be a larger circle. And it wouldn't be quite as tense and tight. So I wasn't so desperate to fit my experience into my view of myself. That's what you're doing with self-view all the time. You're taking your experience and narrowing it down and trying to fit it into a story, into a position. But as time went on, okay, I was still doing that, but there was a larger field within my self-view, and it wasn't held so rigidly. So the next time it went bang, it didn't go bang so loudly, and the fallout, you know, wasn't quite so kind of drastic. But yeah, still shook me up, maybe. But then I also had more metta for myself, which made it easier. And that process would kind of carry on and carry on. And each time, my sense of who I was, who I could be, my sense of my potential, my sense of all the different aspects of myself got larger, and the falling apart got less traumatic, I think is the word I'm looking for. So, and there was also a kind of a move. Let's not talk about me, let's talk in general now, but in general with this process, there's a movement from being very focused on I to increasingly letting in more of other people, more of the world around. So there's a movement from I to we. It's like here, you know, you can probably watch through the day. There are times where you're kind of closing a bit down more on, you know, how am I doing here? And, you know, we're halfway through the retreat now, and how do I feel about how I'm doing and all that. And then there are other times where you're just much more, you know, kind of in the retreat with other people. You feel quite connected. And you can just feel that movement in yourself. It's not like there is a kind of fixed me. There's just a me-ing process. There's a selfing process that goes on. And there are times where there's less of it happening. And you notice, if you watch with mindfulness, you notice that times when you feel more relaxed, more easy in yourself, there's less of that self-referencing going on. And then there's times where something happens and, you know, whatever, you're kind of late for a meal and you think, oh, is there going to be anything left for me? You know, and then you're kind of closing back down on yourself and there's more tension in your body. And that's, yeah, we just do that all the time. So watching that process is really good. And you can do it doing it in your body really gives you good clues to what's going on, to how you're doing it. So you move from I to something more flexible, to we, that allows in more people more of the time. But then finally, with insight practice or just the momentum even of your previous practice, there comes a point where there's a complete letting go. There's no need to keep doing this selfing thing. Yes, you can do it kind of when you need to, on the relative level. You can say, yes, you know, next Tuesday I'm going to be in such and such place. But that belief that there really is a fixed me going through all experience, that's gone. That's disappeared. Yeah. So at that point, you're not really thinking even in terms of we. There's nothing that you can grasp onto that's you. And because of that, in a way, you're everything. You're everything and nothing. It's a very strange world that people who've got to this sort of stage of things live in from a conventional point of view. Yeah, in a way, you're just awareness, you could say. So this process of gradual spiritual death moves through these different stages. Yeah, sort of. That's that tendency to be hunched around what starts off being quite a fixed sense of self, gradually relaxes and opens and becomes softer. There's more room in your heart for other people. There's even room in your heart for them to be different and unique and not like you. And eventually, there's a real heart opening, and then no need to keep doing that tensing around a fixed sense of self. You may still habitually do it, but you don't believe it anymore. You don't believe it in the same sort of way. That, and that's the crucial difference. It's like after this point in the path, yes, you still haven't completely transformed yourself. There's still that tendency to kind of, at times, just kind of close in. But as you're doing it, you know that there's just the closing of the mind. It's not closing round anything. It's not closing to protect me, because there isn't one. So that makes it much easier to work with as time goes on. So that's kind of the process. It's a sort of softening, and you can maybe see why Amitabha is associated with the element fire. Because fire sort of has the effect of softening, transmuting, and melting things. So we start rather hard and rigid and clunky, sort of clunking into other hard, rigid egos, like, you know, dodging cars in a fair when I was a kid. But gradually things get softer and softer. So these are wisdom flames. And in tantric Buddhism, you see a lot of figures that are not sort of peaceful like the five Buddhas, but are more wreathed in flames and look more sort of dangerous. And it's understood that those flames are flames of transformation, they're flames of wisdom. But these figures, when you look at them, represent states of mind that have passed through the flames of shunyata, as the traditional texts say, that have passed through the flames of emptiness, that have been purified of the delusions of being fixed, separate. So fire is a very important image here. As I was preparing the talk, it made me think about the phoenix, because the phoenix is a mythological bird. I think the myth comes from Egypt, if I remember rightly. And there's the kind of comes from the desert, and the phoenix, as it ages, goes onto a bonfire and is reduced, and then is reborn out of the ashes, reborn anew. And apparently, traditionally, there was only one phoenix at a time. So it's quite a symbol of this sort of uniqueness. So, in a way, spiritual death, this movement, involves being prepared to move towards the flames of insight, the flames of wisdom, and to be, as it were, reborn, but in a more flowing, more free way of operating. I'll read you a poem. It's called The Prayer of the Phoenix. Bowing its feathered head before the roaring flames, the phoenix utters its ancient prayer. Homage to the great fire. The time has come. The moment has arrived. I shall leave behind this old beak that pecks constantly at what no longer nourishes. This old voice that croaks the same stale song. These old wings that have forgotten how to soar, flapping feebly back and forth over familiar territory. I approach this fire with a mind of faith. I embrace this fire with a fearless heart. I endure this fire with a patient spirit. Through this death, I shall find new life. Through this heat, I shall cool my mind. Through this suffering, I shall find great bliss. In this fire, I shall forge my freedom. So that was a little about spiritual death. So let's look at the compassion side of things, which is symbolized in one way by the lotus. The lotus symbolizes both sides. The lotus goes through a number of deaths, in a sense. It renounces the mud, it renounces the water, and it finally appears in this whole new medium of the light, in the sunlight. So let's look briefly at compassion. The main quality that develops compassion is empathy. Is the capacity to imagine ourselves into the shoes or the socks, if they're sitting in the shrine room, of other people. To be able to put ourselves in their position. And it comes from our ability to imagine, which is this extraordinary kind of faculty that we've talked about quite a bit on this retreat. So a wonderful use of imagination is just to put ourselves in the position of somebody else and feel what it's like. And when we do that, we find their hopes and fears, their longings, their aspirations, their difficulties. We find all those qualities which we talked about that are the same. That, you know, they suffer because they don't get what they want. They suffer because they get what they don't want. They suffer because they're parted from what they liked. And yes, there's that fundamental unease of knowing on some level or other that they're getting older, that they're vulnerable, they're physically vulnerable to illness. And there's this great unknown of death, or somewhere lurking, waiting. So just being able to empathize with another person tends to create compassion. And one of the wonderful things about human beings is that we can empathize with all kinds of different mental states. It's almost like we can put ourselves into all the six realms of the wheel of life and get a sense for, you know, people in all those six realms. Yeah, we do this kind of through our lives, really. You know, we empathize with people who are in good states, but we can empathize with people, you know, with suffering in ways that we've never suffered. It's like if you hear about people who have been affected by a tsunami, you don't have yourself, you know, to have been in a tsunami and survived, you know, to be able to feel for them. You can just immediately do it. It's as if there's just this part of your heart that just automatically knows how to do it. Although, in a way, the more experience you've had of suffering, the more able you are to empathize. Nobody wants to suffer. Nobody wants to get ill, for instance. But I've certainly found in my life that until I was chronically ill for a period of time, it was much harder for me to empathize with people who did suffer from difficult physical conditions. If you're really hale and hearty and full of life, it's not easy to put yourself in the shoes of somebody who's has very little energy, is suffering in that sort of way. In fact, looking at my life, I now feel I can empathize more because of the various kinds of suffering that I've been through. For instance, there was a period of my life in my very early 20s where I suffered in quite a substantial way. Firstly, at the end of my 3 years at university, I'd spent my last year taking drugs very extensively and comprehensively for a year. At the end of that time, I was a complete nervous wreck. I was shattered. I was more or less broken. And about 2 or 3 years after I pulled myself out of that state by my bootstraps, I was volunteering and then working for a while in a mental hospital in North London. And one day, talking to one of the patients, I got to comparing notes with them, how they were, and how I'd been. And this man said, "Oh, sounds as if you had what I've got. But it sounds as if you had it worse." And then working in a mental hospital also was a very challenging experience, for which I'm really, really grateful. Being with people in extreme states of suffering, sometimes with very distorted stories about the world that they were telling themselves, still you could see the essential humanity in them. You could still see them having the same human responses to things, even though the story that they were telling themselves was largely distorted. So I had this experience of altered states of consciousness with drugs. I had the experience of complete nervous collapse. I had the experience of working in this hospital with people in extreme mental states. And also around that time, the early 70s, there were a lot of encounter groups, where again, it gave me a chance to empathize with the suffering of other people, partly through what I went through myself, but also through watching them. So at the beginning of one of these encounter groups, say it was going on over a weekend, people would turn up, all with their social masks well in place. "My name's Gerald, I work for Barclays Bank. My name's Catherine, I'm a housewife." Or whatever. But then, within an hour or two, we would find ourselves with those masks completely removed. We'd find ourselves stark naked, usually yelling at one another about, you know, things that happened to us in our childhood, you know, our fathers, our mothers, interpersonal difficulties, all kinds of things. It was as if we were reduced right down to the sort of fundamental human level. And beneath all the social masks, beneath those facades, beneath the different kind of social class rankings, all those things, we were just bumping into one another as human beings. So that whole period of my life, I don't want to say, oh, how much I suffered, but it definitely had its difficulties, and I wouldn't have wished those difficulties on anyone else. But looking back, I can see that they did open my heart. They did give me a capacity to empathize with people in all sorts of states, much more so than I'd been able to before. So I'm really grateful for that time in my life, because it did open my heart and it enabled me to feel for others in a way that I couldn't do before. So although, yes, nobody wants to suffer, nobody wants to get ill, nobody wants to lose a job, nobody wants to be bereaved, nobody wants their relationship to break up, and so on and so forth. But when these things happen to us, it does really increase our capacity to empathize, and therefore to help others who have similar experience. we can really go out to them. So empathy is really the heart of compassion. And during this retreat, one of our practices can really be to empathize with one another, to put ourselves in one another's position, particularly if we find somebody difficult in some way, just putting ourselves in their position, feeling that they have their story. There is a reason why they're being so irritating, so unreasonable, and so forth, at least as we see it. We just put ourselves in their position and feel, yes, this is their life and their attempt to be happy in this situation. So we really feel for them. And through empathy, we can feel out what one another need, we can be helpful, and in that way, the retreat will be at least another step or two towards being and feeling like a pure land. So this is compassion, symbolized by the lotus, and the lotus is the open heart. And part of practice involves allowing our heart to become very open, very tender, very sensitive to other people, to the world, and its suffering. This comes out of metta bhavana, out of empathy, out of the whole Dharma emphasis on compassion. And at times that can be an extremely difficult place to be. We don't like to feel vulnerable. And also we can feel even overwhelmed by it. And we can feel compassion fatigue. That's a very popular thing to feel these days. I actually wonder whether what is called compassion fatigue is actually compassion fatigue. It seems to me that often what people are calling compassion fatigue is the fact that they're tired of being manipulated. With the best of intentions, often the campaigns in the media and various organizations to encourage us to help, to give to people in different situations around the world are quite manipulative. They use very strong images in quite manipulative ways. And we may just be fatigued of being manipulated in that way. Or our response to all that may just be guilt. It may not be the actual open-heartedness and tenderness of compassion, which tends naturally just to respond. It may be a guilty sense of, well, we're not in that situation, and somehow we feel uneasy that other people are starving, and here we are, far from starving usually. And so, out of that sense of guilt, which is often being manipulated by the media and by those who want us to give, then we're responding. So, yes, I think you can have fatigue from being manipulated. I think you can have guilt fatigue. I'm not so sure whether you can have compassion fatigue. I'm not so sure whether your heart can break out of genuine compassion. Genuine compassion is a state of tenderness and openness, certainly, and you can feel deeply moved. You can feel temporarily overwhelmed with grief and just the longing for that suffering to come to an end, for the longing for all the suffering in the world to come to an end. That's natural. In fact, it helps to open your heart. On the Total Immersion retreat in the summer, there was one morning where Yashobodhi was teaching, and she was talking about compassion and the wounded heart. And there were several people in the meditation afterwards who were in floods of tears. I was one of them. And temporarily, yes, you feel overwhelmed. But actually, you emerge from that feeling cleansed, purified, more open to life than before. That sense that you could just be overwhelmed and reduced to a pool of tears and never recover That sense that your heart could break in contemplating the sufferings of the world, I believe, is not really true. I think it's a fear created by our sense of needing to stay in control. The ego story is a way of kind of keeping ourselves, in a sense, in control, in limited, narrow, safe, secure bounds. And so one of the ways in which that works is that when we start moving out of the rational, out of our heads, into deeper feeling, often the alarm bells go off, and the story we tell ourselves is that we shall go completely to the other extreme. So perhaps we don't usually experience much anger or aversion, and on the retreat we start finding, yes, there's definitely some anger there. But then this little voice goes, but if you really feel that, you'll turn into the mad axe man. You'll just go berserk. You'll just run amok, destroying things, you know, in a blind rage. So best not to go there. Best not to feel that feeling at all. And so we repress it. We shove it down again. Whereas actually, yes, if you're not used to and easy with your experience of anger, that may come up quite strongly for a while. But you won't turn into a homicidal maniac. You can trust the Dharma, you can trust your awareness, you can trust your own mind. Yes, your ego cage may be really rattled, but that catastrophic consequence won't happen. And it's the same with grief. It's the same with certainly the sadness of that's born of compassion, that's born of contemplating the suffering of the world. It feels like your heart will break. But actually, that heart that you feel will break, I would say, isn't your real heart. It's like a fake Rolex. You know, it isn't the real thing. The contemplation of the suffering of living beings in the context of the Dharma as a generation of compassion. Yes, it will break your heart open, but your heart will turn into a great red lotus, full of care for life. Yes, you'll feel very tender, very sensitive, but that will be a responsiveness to life. That will be an interactiveness with life. That will be something very, very beautiful. So empathy creates compassion. And this compassion deepens and deepens as we follow the path. In fact, in some Mahayana texts, there are three levels of compassion mentioned. You'll find this, for instance, in the chapter on loving kindness of the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, Gampopa. So the first level is compassion for suffering living beings. Just straightforward, everyday feeling. Yeah? There has been an earthquake. There are people suffering. Someone you know has lost their father. So there's just a straightforward response to the everyday suffering of life. And that's where we start. But then as we practice more deeply ourselves, as we go more deeply into our experience of the Dharma, as we learn more and reflect more and meditate more on the Dharma, so we start to see how the Dharma really is liberating. We start to see how the Dharma is a description of how things are and how to live life so that you don't suffer. So then your compassion becomes more based on that. Your compassion is for living beings who don't understand the Dharma, who just take life and themselves and things as how they are. And they haven't heard the Four Noble Truths. They're not aware of how they create their own suffering. Suffering is all about the fact that, you know, someone did you wrong, times are hard. It's all external. So, as we come to see the Dharma ourselves and practice it more and more, there's that compassion for living beings who just don't have that understanding, who haven't had the opportunity, or when they have, they haven't taken the opportunity to see the path, to see how life is. And then, as our own practice goes even deeper, we come to what's called objectless compassion. When we don't just know about the Dharma and attempt to put it into practice, when we actually come to some direct seeing of the Dharma, seeing how everything is ungraspable, everything is a flow of conditions, everything in that sense is not permanent and real and fixed and existing, then we have compassion for beings who grasp at things as if they were really existent, who grasp at themselves as if there really is a fixed me that has to fight to get to the top of the tree, and fixed real things that they can put confidence in until those things change. So there are these three levels of compassion. It goes deeper and deeper on the path until finally compassion and wisdom come together. There's the understanding, the direct insight into how things are, and the compassion that flows out from that. But it doesn't flow out from a really existent person to other really existent beings. Everything has gone beyond that very crude way of looking at things. But wisdom and compassion have come together. And this is why Amitabha's two hands are together. The right hand of the body, traditionally in Indo-Tibetan Buddhism, is associated with compassion, and this active compassion going out into the world to help. And the left side of the body is the wisdom side, always relaxed, always dwelling in the nature of things. So the right and left hands of Amitabha come together in a mudra, uniting both. So, we've explored discriminating wisdom a little, being special. We've explored the wisdom aspect of bodhicitta in that way. And we've looked at the compassion aspect, the empathy aspect, the open lotus of the heart, different levels of compassion. And as we practice with Amitabha, we transform. We can transform in the fires of loving kindness, in the fires of wisdom. And earlier I read you that Phoenix poem. So I'd like to finish with a second poem. I wrote both these poems on retreat at Rivendell. That's about 2006, I think it was. So this one is called Gratitude of the Phoenix. Plumage shining, the phoenix spreads new wings and sings its first spontaneous song. I entered the flames at sunset, flames that seared and burned and devoured the world. My feathers turned to ashes. My wings turned to ashes. My flesh and sinews turned to ashes. My thoughts turned to ashes. Memories turned to ashes. Hopes and expectations drifted away on the smoke from the funeral pyre. I was so reduced, so almost nothing, a few ounces of greyness beneath the desert stars, that it seemed the night wind would rise and scatter me forever. But all was stillness and silence. As I waited, patiently enough, for something. Something I could no longer remember. But nothing happened. The ashes grew cold and dim in the chill of the night. And still nothing. Until at last it dawned on me. I must give up waiting, even patiently, for anything at all. I must love these ashes as I loved my life. At that, a tiny ember glowed in the midst of the darkness and became a single, miraculous, golden feather. In that one moment, I remembered my destiny. With all the love of my heart, I kindled the crumbled grey powder back into life. By the time the sun had crept upon my funeral pyre, I was whole and made anew, reflecting its rays from wings of red and gold. And I am grateful to the fire, grateful to the night, grateful to the ashes that gave me birth, as I set out on fresh wings into an unexplored sky. So that was our talk, and there are some areas that you might like to explore in your groups. So the first one is the whole image of Amitabha, the associations with him, how you respond to those, where you can make connections for yourself, for your own practice. Secondly, there's this whole thing of feeling special, needing to be special. In what ways is that a positive thing, if it is? And in what ways is it a negative thing, if it is? And then thirdly, spiritual death. What does that mean to you? Can you relate to it on your own level? And then fourthly, there's the whole issue of empathy, which I've said is the heart of compassion. It's the key to compassion. So we could explore how we are practicing empathy, where it has its limits, where it's working for us. And then lastly, more generally, the issue of compassion, and particularly this thing of compassion fatigue, overwhelm. What prevents us, again, what limits us from going more deeply into the heart of compassion, into the heart of Amitabha?